You're listening to the PES on KZUU 90.7 FM, broadcasting live from the Ivory Tower, the third floor of the Cub. On the show today, we're going to have Chris Warren, the politically incorrect comic. We're going to talk to Bob Wolin, the coach of the Pullman Greyhounds, and talk about their championship season they just recently finished up. Also, we'll talk a little bit about technology. In the meantime, let me play everybody at PSA so I don't get in trouble.
Are you in need of free legal advice? Contact Student Legal Services for a free 30-minute consultation. Visit their office in Cub 316 or call 335-9539.
Need a place to live? Looking for a roommate? The ASWSU Housing Commission can help. Visit the Housing Commission's website at cub.wsu.edu/hb for renter's guide and housing listings. They will also place an ad for you for free. For more info, call 235-9574.
Hug a tree, man. I have no idea how this stuff works, man. We got these tree huggers running around all over the place, and they crack me up because they constantly protest the use of paper products and the use of wood products. And how do they do that? They take a cardboard sign and nail it to a wooden stick. Then they show up to their protest in a 1971 Volkswagen van spewing smoke out of the back, leaving an oil slick on the road that would make a drunken tanker captain happy. Then they wipe their butts with Charmin and tell us we're violating the environment. Get the hell out of my face, man. I swear to God.
Everybody, Chris Warren. The politically incorrect comic has been spewing forth his rhetoric on stages coast to coast and throughout Canada for 17 years, delighting his audience with his high-energy, fast-paced style, even as he tears apart the core beliefs of the politically correct, the environmental extremists, the religious freaks, and the animal rights activists. He has honed his craft to the point where he can attack these touchy subjects with killer humor and disarming smile, so that even those who adamantly disagree with his sense of humor still roar with laughter and approval, even as he tries to sell them baby seal head covers for their golf clubs. It's all in the delivery, he says with a grin. You could say virtually anything as long as you're smiling and friendly. If I told some of my material with anger and an edge in my voice, someone would kill me. Chris has released his second CD covered in blood to complement his first, politically correct, this. His overtrip seas to the Persian Gulf as part of the Comics on World Tour was a great success. He has headlined major clubs throughout the U.S. and Canada and appears in numerous commercials and is open for Bad Company, Edgar Winter, and Paul Revere and the Raiders. He's a favorite of corporates for his ability to work clean and one-nighters for his ability to work dirty. Chris is extremely versatile and able to read and satisfy and entertain audiences of all make and description. Chris is also part of The Right Stuff, a tour of conservative-leaning comics that is seen around the country during the last election cycle. Chris is one half of a hysterical Bitter Man show, a look at relationships from a male's perspective, featuring himself in comedian Chris Alpine. Watch for Chris Warren, the politically incorrect comic. Well, Chris, welcome to the PES. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you, my friend?
I am not doing too bad. It's great to have you on the air.
Do we sound clear?
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
You sound good. I've been up to your club a couple times, and actually the first time I went up there was when it was still in the sports ticket, I believe it was.
Yeah, the season ticket.
Season ticket, that's the one. And The night I actually went up, we were supposed to see some, I think he was billed as the oldest hippie or something like that, and he wasn't able to make it. So instead, we actually got a presentation of you. So,
yeah, I remember Jim Wiggins got caught in a huge snowstorm over in Denver and simply couldn't make it in.
Yep, that's what it was, come to think about it. So, yeah, that was, so I had an opportunity to see you way back in the day, and then Of course, I was up there just recently when I asked you to come on the show and talk about your trips to over to the Middle East, and that's what we're going to talk a little bit about today, and hopefully it will be both fun and a little bit of a learning for some people, because I know, you know, they only get news from one source, and it's usually the media. Hopefully they'll learn a little bit from somebody who's been there and seen everything with his own eyes and actually has been in the thick of things, and dare I say, even been in a situation where, you know, your life could have even been threatened, or at least you sure felt that way at the time, I suppose.
Well, I hope some of the people listening today have a bit of an open mind, because I know this is such a polarizing issue, and people have a tendency that if they hear things that don't seem to fit their perspective, they just poo-poo it and disregard it and don't want to hear it at all. And it works on both sides. I've seen it happen. There's a lot of extremism and polarity out there, and people are very, very strong in their views, but the fact of the matter is we're just not getting the truth out of the media.
There you go. And I totally agree with that, and especially after reading a lot of what you said here, it's, you know, we're definitely not hearing the whole story, and we're not hearing a lot of the great things that you were seeing over there, and even some of the things that you described over there with the kids and being by the freeways and stuff like that. It's amazing. You know, and the first thing you were talking about here was on April 20th. You were talking about the culture shock of getting to the airport itself, and, you know, more or less being the only white guys and in the area, and you know, just sort of the it's almost feels intimidating.
Oh, very much so. You step off the plane in Kuwait City and walk into the terminal, and it's a sea of robes and headdresses, and you realize that you stand out like a sore thumb, as if you were dressed like Santa Claus in a regular airport. I mean, and the thing of it was, that was amazing to me, is we were basically ignored. It wasn't like there were hard stares, and I'm sure there were a few. There were so many people in there. But, you know, I didn't feel... Initially, I felt intimidated in my own mind, but that goes away in time when you realize that people aren't singling you out for any kind of ridicule or attack. And so everybody was real, real friendly in Kuwait. Part of the reason, I'm sure, is, you know, they had been liberated from Saddam back in 91 anyway, and they're still very thankful for that. And so people were really, really cool. And I know they see a lot of Westerners anyway, because we've been shuttling in and out of there for some time now.
Sure, so... So they definitely have a long-term memory. They haven't forgotten 6 months later.
Oh, absolutely not. And you walk into the terminal, and there's a Starbucks, and there's a, you know, a Burger King, and that was kind of surprising, because you see Burger King and Starbucks in English with the Arabic written underneath it, and they're busier than heck. I mean, people are frequenting these places, and they're doing quite well. And that was one of the things that happened. As we go through Kuwait City, you see Ford dealerships and Honda dealerships, and basically... you know, everything you would see here in the States, along with, of course, a whole bunch of other stuff, but everything written in English and, again, in Arabic, and so it's definitely unique.
Crazy. So, looks like the first show you did was at the Ali Al-Salem Air Base?
On this last trip, yeah. And that was interesting as well. We pull into the parking lot, and they have, you know, the little concrete divider barriers that we have on the freeway when they're doing freeway construction, the movable... Mm-hmm. What, 10-foot long, 3-foot high type barriers. They have those all over the place, of course, on the base for security purposes. And as we pulled into the DFAC, the dining facility is what that is, they don't call them mess halls anymore, there was a big, giant, hand-painted Fairchild logo, and I thought that was really, really cool, with Fairchild being right outside of Spokane here, to see that at Ali Al-Salem on the Iraqi border. So, that was pretty cool.
That is cool. So you had a great big stage, 300 people in the crowd. You were the only comic there. What's that like, being the one and only man?
Well, you know what? I really like that. For one thing, it's a bit of a challenge, because if you don't get the crowd right away, it can be an awful long show. And so, but, you know, these guys are dying, and men and women, I should say, they're dying for entertainment, and their reception was unbelievable, and they just loved it. And I've done so many military shows now that I know how to go right for it and get them on my side right away, and then you wind up having a really, really fun time. And these guys are great, and they're so appreciative, and they want the autograph, and they want the pictures, and it's a very, very rewarding thing to be able to go over there and participate in such a small way.
So you get to the crowds right away. Does that usually involve the majors and the colonels and a little bit of poking fun at them?
The quickest thing in the world to do is go for the brass, you bet. And, you know, and generally as a rule, and it's, there's always exceptions, of course, you know, they play along with it. They know that it's for morale purposes for the soldiers, and, you know, you start ripping on the brass, you're fine. I actually walked up to a two-star general at one point. He had two stars on his lapel, and I grabbed his lapel and asked him if he was the astronomer. And I'm sure... and he said, yes, yes, I'm the astronomer. And, you know, he took it well. But at that particular point, where I was about to do a show for a bunch of generals and brass that they were seeing off one of their own who was getting reassigned to Okinawa. And he was actually... the top Marine at Camp Victory in Baghdad. So I wound up doing a show for all this brass. I figured I better do something. And sure enough, they were with it all the way. It was great. Yeah,
that's cool. And then the after the show, it sounds like you were getting coins. What are these?
Well, they're called challenge coins, and virtually every division, every ship, every group, they all have their own coin that is made specifically for their group, and they trade them back and forth, and if you happen to be in a bar and somebody has a challenge coin and you don't, you're buying the rounds, and the Army or the military is really big on their coins, and I must have 50 of them by now, and they vary in size from twice the size of a silver dollar to... silver dollar size, and they're all very intricate, very well made, and it's quite the honor to receive these things, and well, it's amazing how many of them I've collected over the last few years.
Do you have them on display at your club?
I don't have them at the club on display. I have them at home on display, actually. I have some amazing memorabilia that I've been able to pull out of there. They actually let us walk into, when we were in Baghdad, the very first palace that was hit the very first night of the war when they thought that they'd nailed Saddam. And it's Uday's palace. And when we were there, they allowed us to walk in and amongst the rubble. And at one point, they even said we could take some souvenirs. And so I brought home a piece of marble and some wood lattice that had been destroyed in that JDAM attack on that palace. And sure enough, I got some pretty good stuff out of there.
That's cool.
Yeah, I bought a really nice coin at an Iraqi souk, an outdoor shop, that was minted in Babylon sometime way back, 3,500 years ago. I've got a lot of stuff that I brought back. It was really cool.
That is cool. It'd be sort of fun if you had a little bit of a display at your club from time to time and let people take a check that stuff out.
Well, I have the intention of doing so. Inside the club, we do have some display cases, and it is one of the things on the list of to do, and that is a very, very long list, believe me, and I'll get there. But I have a box full of shrapnel and spent shells and pieces of pottery from Ur and that coin that I mentioned and the challenge coins, and I've got thousands of Iraqi dinar and all kinds of stuff that we were allowed to bring back, and some of it I probably wasn't supposed to bring back. I got it back anyway, so.
Alrighty. So, at one point you said, we got some disquieting news, however. The road to Baghdad is pretty hot right now with increasing activity. We were briefed on how to deal with everything from Humvee rollovers to insurgent attacks. We've been informed there are several decision points, meaning we won't know if the way is clear until we get there. It's sounding a bit ominous, but we're assured that we're with the best, and they know the route, and they know what they're doing. I asked the captain in charge of the convoy if I get a weapon, and he told me no, civilians cannot have weapons. But then he smiled a bit and said, but if they're shooting and I see you grab something and shoot back, I ain't going to tell you to put it down.
That's exactly right. And Command Sergeant Major Chambliss, who was the head of that particular task force, he told me at one point that if it gets to the point that I need to be shooting, there should be plenty of weapons lying around. So that really wasn't a very very good tip right there either. But I had an M4 with me basically at all times, a clip in my pocket, and a weapon within range. And while it wasn't assigned to me, it was an extra that was in the Humvee that was there. And, you know, one of the things that was so cool about it was being part of the mission. This last trip over was with the Texas National Guard. It was a media mission, and what they were doing is taking media over to see what the troops do to bring those stories back to the folks at home. Well, what the Texas National Guard does is convoy protection and IED hunting, so that's what we did. And with the convoy protection, what happens is there is a constant stream of trucks running between Kuwait and Baghdad bringing supplies, big 18-wheelers in in convoys as many as 30, 50 trucks sometimes. Our particular convoy had 29. And the mission of the Texas National Guard is to run protection for these convoys. So there was a group of about 6 or 7 Humvee gun trucks that we were in. They would run point, they would run the rear, they would run alongside as we went up and down the highway. And that's what we were doing. So I was in the back of the Humvee on the driver's side, and it was my job to keep my eyes open on the left side of the vehicle for any activity. And if any activity was spotted, then there was various procedures that we were supposed to go through. And these were actual missions. People have said to me, well, you only saw what the military wanted you to see, and that is so far from the truth that it's not even realistic. We were on actual missions. We drove from Kuwait City to Baghdad, then we drove from Baghdad over to Fallujah, and it's not a joke. It's the real thing. It's what they do. We went on an IED hunt where you search the side of the freeway. It was a 6-lane highway, just like I-90 is, and we were walking along the side of the freeway looking for bombs, and we found one and had to wait while EOD came and blew the sucker up. We were out there 7 hours. We were running. We were actually a point in our particular gun truck to where we had stopped traffic moving to the south while they were working on detonating this device, and the folks behind us were stopping traffic moving to the north. So we were at an overpass controlling traffic, controlling local population, and exposed for 7 hours out on the freeway. There's no doubt, as long as we were out there, that the bad guys knew where we were. One of the things that was so exciting about that particular deal is it was an Iraqi teenager that pointed out where the IED was. That's how we found it. As we were walking the road, he come running down and pointed it out to us. So it was a local that turned it in. And if you watch the news, you will hear that more and more frequently, that it's the locals that are turning in these types of devices, because they're sick and tired of it as well. And they're indiscriminate. They're killing local civilians and kids as well as they are military people, and they're fed up with it. We had a Bedouin, while we were waiting, come in and turn in hundreds of names to us of local terrorists and insurgents, because same thing. He's moving his flock all around and running into caches of weapons and artillery shells that are lying around out in the desert, and they're turning him in constantly because it's distracting from their way of life as well, and they're fed up with it. They're fed up with the insurgency. Most of the insurgency is either Ba'ath Party members that lost their rank, lost their status, and they're pissed, frankly. I hope I can say that. There's also insurgents coming in from out of the country. Foreigners that are simply there to fight the jihad, to fight the coalition. There's a criminal element of folks that simply got out of jail under Saddam's regime or were criminals on the loose anyway that are simply taking advantage of opportunity with the chaos going on. And there's also the religious zealots. And so there's a big group of people that are fighting the coalition that have nothing to do with the local Iraqi populace and have nothing to do with looking out for their benefit. And they have put themselves in a position to where the Iraqis want them out. And I believe Rumsfeld said the other day, we got 27 million Iraqis fighting 10,000 insurgents. And essentially that's correct. That's what's happening. And, you know, there's also a process to where they are running. You know, they can't go to Weapons R Us and keep rebuilding their stock, you know.
Sure.
When they blow something up, that's one less bomb they have. There's limited resources. And we were told in Fallujah, as a matter of fact, that more and more of the weapons that are being shelled upon them or that they're finding are duds because they're scraping the bottom of the barrel. They don't have a way to replenish their resources. They don't have factories churning out munitions. They don't have supply lines. What they have is what they have, and when it's gone, it's gone. And so the insurgency clearly is numbered. The days are numbered, I should say. The population has made it clear through 3 elections now. They're very, very proud of the fact that they have voted. The stuff that's going on over there in the way of rebuilding schools, power supplies, water supplies, all of that is continuing on, and they're very appreciative. You know, you hear about rebuilding Iraq and it conjures up an image that we flattened it first and then now we're putting it back together, and nothing could be further from the truth there either. You have to drive around Baghdad to find battle damage because they were so specific on what they hit. And when you go into the smaller towns, they were bypassed by the military. They weren't just overrun and destroyed. It's nothing like that at all. When we're rebuilding Iraq, it's rebuilding decrepit, falling apart power plants, water supply, stuff like that, that had simply been neglected, and that's the stuff that we're getting up and running again. Not when they say rebuilding Iraq, it does not mean fixing what we broke. It means fixing what was falling apart, because we didn't break most of it, very little of it. When we drove, I saw more damage in New Orleans than I saw driving from Kuwait City to Baghdad and over to Fallujah, and that is no joke. That is absolutely no joke, because the battles were fought either in the open or for strategic places like airports and such like that. We weren't bombing downtown Baghdad for the sake of bombing downtown Baghdad. They were hitting very specific military-sensitive targets. And as you drive through the cities, you see that, because you can go forever and never see a broken building, nothing. But then you'll come around a corner and find what was obviously a significant target that's been leveled. It's just the perception that is out there is that has been perpetrated by the media is completely wrong. You know, I swear they take their reporters, they run them out of the hotel, they put them in front of a pile of rubble, they do their news report, they run back to the hotel. That's the extent of their knowledge. They don't get outside the wire, they don't get outside the protected zones, and the reports they send back show rubble and destruction, giving the impression that that's how the country is, and it flat is not. It just flat is not.
So you said it was a killer scene. After a bit, the teachers and the administrators pulled me into their quote-unquote office, one of the three huts, and asked to be photographed as well. The administrator then asked me to give copies of the shots to Major S, who had been working with them on the new school project. So these three huts were actually part of the school that they had over there?
Actually, those three huts were the school. And there are some pictures on the website at brickwallcomedy.com if anybody wants to check those out. But they literally were mud huts, thatched roofs, what, maybe 20 feet long, maybe 15 feet wide, and there were three of them shaped like a U. One of those buildings was the office for the administrator, and, you know, it was mud floors, a hole cut in the wall for the window, and some handmade desks and such, and that's what the kids had for a school. We went over to the school opening for the school that we built for that town, which was a joint U.S.-Iraqi effort, and it was a modern school with electricity and ceiling fans and nice desks and chalkboards and a courtyard in between the buildings, and it was an honest-to-God real school. And I tell you what, people can say what they will, but you cannot fake the emotion of a child. I don't care what you tell them. And they were so excited to be out of the mud hut and into a modern building. It was just a fascinating, touching, moving experience, and something that is occurring on a daily basis. They're opening schools all over the place constantly. And that generation of children is the future, after all. And those are the kids that are so thankful for what's been going on over there, for lifting the repression, for bringing modern facilities to their isolated towns. And this particular town was in the southern part of Iraq, where Saddam had cut off the entire water supply to the southern half of the nation. And this town was on the edge of a dried lake bed. We drove across this lake bed for quite some time in the Humvees to get to this town. Saddam had dried it out. It had used to been a very fertile area, an agricultural area, and it is now just bone-dry desert because Saddam had cut off the canals and altered rivers in an attempt to basically starve out the southern half of the country.
Wow. You said it's so striking. Kuwait is a very rich country. Less than a mile into the Iraq, the poverty is just incredible. It blows you away. Kids everywhere waving their hands, holding up water bottles, motioning to their mouth that they want something to drink, something to eat. And you were actually told not to give them anything.
that was one of the hardest things. Kuwait is a very oil-rich country. Everybody's there's a lemon law there. You can't have a car older than 7 years on the road. I mean, it's ridiculous. And the downtown is beautiful, and it's a rich country, there's no doubt. You cross the border, and I swear it's like going from the South Hill into Hilliard with a half a mile different, and then kick it up by, oh, I guess that wouldn't be a good reference for Pullman, but then you kick it up by, you know, hook the steroids up. It was just, the poverty was, I had never seen anything like that here in America, flat out. And to have it happen with less than a mile apart, razor wire and border crossing, separating the rich from the poor like that, if you will, was amazing. And to see these kids on the side of the road with empty bottles motioning to their mouths, it tears you apart, and you want to help immediately. But the problem is, the way it was explained, you throw something out, you start essentially a stampede. And if it's anywhere near the highway, they're not watching. There's vehicles, these convoys are going by, you know, they're getting hit. The other thing that happens is the little kid grabs the water, a bigger kid takes it from him, a bigger kid takes it from him, the fight is on, and it's a huge battle. So we were told not to throw anything from the vehicles to these kids for that very reason, because of the kind of stampede and damage and danger that it put the kids in. Later, when we were up at the school that you had talked about, I had brought all kinds of power bars and such to give out, but there were too many kids, and I was told, again, leave it in the Humvee, because if we start handing it out and there's not enough for everybody, we're essentially going to start a riot. And so we did. We kept it put away rather than handing it out and creating an incident. So it's amazing to see that, because it's just something that we are never exposed to.
So while you're over there, you've seen the home of Abraham, and you said he's essentially considered the father of the three major religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. What was it like to essentially be a witness to that?
Well, that's an amazing thing as well. That was near Tallil, probably about halfway, maybe a third of the way between Kuwait City and Baghdad, it's the ruins of an old civilization, and to be able to walk through that, knowing that all those thousands of years ago, this was the home of the birthplace of all these religions, is a very profound experience. There were caves where there were prisons, and there were areas where there had been workers, areas that had been for the royalty. You could see the difference between all of that. It was an amazing thing. You had mentioned briefly about, when we talked earlier, about being able to do what the public will not be able to do. We walk through these ruins, and when the time comes that the economy is okay and security is okay and tourism returns to that country, which it will, they will be roped off and they will be shuttled through specific ways of walking through that to create, you know, the least amount of damage and not be able to get into the actual sites. We were given a tour by a local guide there that walked us right into some of these caverns, into some of these crypts, through some of the houses, and we had the up close and personal touching of this kind of stuff, and it was amazing. And the same thing happened in Babylon. When I was there a year and a half earlier, we got to walk through the ruins, just, you know, handfuls of us, two and three at a time. And of course, we were very cautious with where we went and what we did. But now they've already roped that off, and they're not letting people walk through there because they don't want it to be defaced and damaged. And so, yeah, we definitely had the treat there, without a doubt.
That's,
of course, it was 115 degrees in the naked broiling sun. And, but you know what? It was still just an enlightening experience, very profound.
It would be pretty amazing to be able to go to a, you know, I mean, you know, you can't go to most places in America and find something that, you know, has that kind of history, you know, 3,500 years ago. Or, you know,
I can't imagine anywhere that you can go in America where you can have that.
No, it's. I think that's just. It's to be able to go up close and actually see something like that. It would blow my mind away.
Yeah, it's just amazing to walk the floors that that these people had walked in all those thousands of years ago. Broken pottery all over the place. There's drainage systems that where erosion had worn it away underneath some of the houses, where you could see how they had hooked up drainage. And it was amazing. It was just absolutely amazing. Now, that particular area, once again, used to have been very, very fertile, but the river had been altered, and now it's just dry, baked desert. So Daeed, the guy that was our tour guide, his family had been tour guides through Ur and through the house of Abraham for generations, and was very, very knowledgeable. And he had no problem ripping into Saddam and the things that Saddam had done. And it was interesting to hear the local Iraqi just go off like that. It was it was very passionate. And it was, again, you know, this whole thing has been so life-changing that I keep saying the word profound, but boy, I tell you, there's just no other way to describe it. It just touches you so deeply. It's an amazing experience. And this is the stuff that never gets broadcast on the news. We get bombs and body counts, and that's it. You know, we don't get any local flavor. We don't get, you know, we went shopping in outdoor souks and met with so many Iraqis and discussed the situation with them and saw how they are and how they treated us and all the rest of it. And that's the stuff that just never gets back to America. And it's sad because there just seems to be a manipulation of the news, and it's very frustrating.
So you, along the way, you arrive in, I believe it's Scania. And you had a show there. Sounds like there's a Colonel N, and he told you all the things he was going to do to you if you ripped on him.
That was hilarious. He was begging to be a part of the show. he came up to me as soon as I got there, and he was the commander of the base, and he did. He proceeded to tell me all the nasty things that were going to happen to me if I included him in the show, and the more he went on, the more it was obvious that he was dying to be part of the show. And at one point, he had threatened me with his bodyguards. He had threatened to make me sleep outside the wire. He had done a number of things. And the following day is when we went on the IED hunt and found one, and he told me he was going to send me out in the field to tap around and try and find him with my foot, you know. And but he was a great guy, and he sat in the front row, and every time I tore into him, the crowd just went absolutely stark raving wild, and he loved it, they loved it, and that was one of the best shows of the entire tour. And that particular colonel, I'm looking forward to having a beer with him sometime in Texas. It'll be great.
That's
great.
It
was amazing.
So you talked about, you went to one of Saddam's palaces, which is now a VIP headquarters for dignitaries, and you were talking that that this one room, the bedroom, was 40 feet long, 25 feet wide, essentially a 1,000 square foot room, bedroom, 25 foot ceilings, but then you talked about how poorly they were actually constructed.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing, because the gaudiness of it is striking, especially when you see the poverty of the local populace. These palaces are in huge compounds. Give you an idea how big one of them was. You're familiar with the Bloomsday race here in Spokane, right?
Yeah.
7.46 mile race. Well, I was in Baghdad for this last Bloomsday, and I managed to convince the organizers to allow me to run Bloomsday in Baghdad, which I did. And I ran it at Camp Victory, which is where the Water Palace is. And that compound is so huge, and there's hundreds of buildings on it. And it's just one compound of something like 32 across the country. Well, I ran Bloomsday, and I never lapped the compound. We ran 7.5 miles and didn't even come close to lapping the compound. It's that big of a property. And so there's dozens and dozens and dozens of palaces and support buildings and various different buildings that are on each one of these complexes. Now, the one you're referring to is in Tikrit, which is the hometown of Saddam, and it was not very far from where they actually found him. And this one was absolutely that. It was a receiving palace for dignitaries, and it's been turned into essentially a hotel by the U.S. troops. And that compound was every bit as large as the Water Palace compound as well. Well, the building is just unreal. You can't believe how big it is. The architecture is fabulous. You go inside and it's just so ornate and gold everywhere and marble everywhere. It's amazing. But when you look close and you see how tacky and poorly it's built, how some of the stuff that looks so ornate is basically just stapled to the wall for the look, and how the chandeliers look like they're diamond chandeliers, but it's cheap plastic glass. As you look at it closer, you see that it definitely was built for looks and the gaudiness, but the construction was very, very, very poor, and that was surprising to me. You know, it's like dressing up a Pinto, you know what I mean? It's still a Pinto. But just the vastness of the rooms and the vastness of the buildings. I mean, the Davenport Hotel pales in comparison, I keep forgetting that I'm not on a Spokane radio station. The palaces make it look like garbage, and yet as you look at the construction and you see the poorly fitted walls and all the rest of it, it's very surprising.
So you're listening to KZUU 90.7 FM. This is the PS with Chris Warren, the politically incorrect comic. We're talking about his trip over to Iraq and Baghdad late April, early May of 2005?
Yeah, I think I got back May 2nd or 3rd, maybe the 4th, something like that.
So you said the show went on as scheduled, 1,300 hours inside a large room at another palace. Played the palace, baby. As with all of them so far, the reception was amazing. The show went off great, and we had a great time. Handshaking and photo ops forever. I cannot say enough about how good it feels to bring a few laughs to these people and how grateful they are.
Well, it's absolutely the truth, and each show is the same way, and you know, I love doing comedy anyway. We tend to take people out of their lives and make them forget about their problems and have a laugh with us, and it's fun, and I've always admired that part of it. As being my job, it's very rewarding, but it's tenfold when you go over to a war zone, and they're so appreciative that you take the risk, because at any point, you know, we did a show in at Balad in Anaconda, which is it's an LSA base. It's a staging base for all the supplies for all the other bases. Huge, huge place. We had 1,500 people in a soccer stadium we did a show for. I was told prior to that I had to go up because they forgot to have the MC and the other comics mention it, so I get up, and the first thing I was supposed to do, according to the commander, was explain our procedure in case of mortar attack. I mean, that's going to bring a comedy show down just a little bit. But we were close enough to the wire that we were clearly within range of any mortar strike, and there had to be, you know, some plan for that. And so at any given point, we're within fire zone, you know. We didn't take any direct fire on this particular trip. We did hear some fire. We did get mortared at one point at Tikrit. There was a lot of incidents that did occur. When I say we didn't take any direct fire, nothing was directed at our convoy or hit our Humvee, but we definitely heard fire, and we definitely heard a lot of mortar in Fallujah. It just wasn't close enough to, you know, do us any damage. But, you know, that's the thing. It's once you go in country, you're in a war zone. We're issued flak jackets, the IBAs, we're issued helmets, and we're constantly in a war zone. And especially on this trip, the first one was flying around from base to base and it was a little safer, but this last trip we were doing convoy. We were out there doing missions with the troops. And we spent more time outside the wire than we did inside the wire. And outside the wire meaning we're off the base where everybody's running red or black, they're loaded up, their weapons are hot, and we're targets. Simple as that.
So one thing you said on your website, and this was actually in bold, and I think this was the only thing in bold, but I thought this was very important, and I want to repeat it. Support for the insurgency is waning rapidly, even in the Sunni region. In addition, as we learned later in our briefing from Colonel Hall and TQ, the Sunnis are seeing that we are not the devils we're made out to be. In fact, as the towns see the benefit of what we're doing, other towns are opening their arms, realizing the perception they've had of us is incorrect, and that we are really helping. And each day, another door is opened, another weapon is set down, and progress is being made. Why do we never hear that on the news?
That's very frustrating that we don't, but, you know, part of that is that's not sexy. It doesn't sell. You know what I'm saying? The bomb and body count thing, they know there's... I believe that most of the media has an agenda anyway, and I don't think that's a good thing. Certainly, world opinion, you know, you get some of the UK press, you get Al Jazeera, they're no doubt about where they're going with this stuff. They don't want it to have any positive at all, and the positive gets lost. It's just, you know, a school opening pales in comparison to an IED that kills 10, and they're just going to constantly push that IED that kills 10. That's more important than the fact that another Sunni town has laid down its arms. Near Fallujah, there were three little towns that were Sunni-controlled, and they refused to even deal with us at first. One of them came around, saw what we did with garbage disposal, water supply, school openings, and the word trickled back to the other two towns, and slowly, one by one, they did. They laid down their arms. People, you know, the colonel there was explaining to us how when they first went through the town, you know, they're armed up and they're doing patrols and people are not even coming outside, and slowly people were coming out. Then they were waving, and before long they got to know them. And one of the Sunni leaders in particular was a holdout and refused to cooperate or even meet. And the very day that we